From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! NATO airstrikes continue against Yugoslavia. What do the bombs cost? Which companies benefit? Reports say the four New York police officers who killed Amadou Diallo will be indicted for second-degree murder, and the protests continue. A major explosion at Chevron's oil refinery on San Francisco Bay. Doctors have been treating hundreds of people coming into area hospitals. And the burying of radioactive waste. What are the risks to the environment? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! NATO's supreme military commander says a third wave of airstrikes against Yugoslavia will begin today. General Wesley Clark says the attacks will focus on further reducing Yugoslavia's air defenses. Clark says NATO has seriously damaged the Yugoslav military. NATO yesterday launched a second night of airstrikes on Yugoslavia, firing on Serb targets from ships in the Adriatic. Dozens of NATO warplanes took off from Allied bases in Italy, and four warships in the Adriatic launched Tomahawk cruise missiles at Serb targets. Meanwhile, pro-Yugoslav demonstrators armed with rocks and gasoline bombs broke windows at the U.S. embassy in the Macedonian capital of Skopje and set fire to cars to express their opposition to NATO airstrikes. We'll have more on this later in the show. The Associated Press is reporting that a grand jury has indicted second-degree murder charges against four New York City police officers who fatally shot Amadou Diallo, an unarmed Guinean immigrant. The four white officers, Edward McMillan, Sean Carroll, Kenneth Boss, and Richard Murphy, fired 41 bullets at Diallo, who stood in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building on February 4th. 19 of the bullets hit him. Details of the reported indictment were expected to be made public on Monday at the earliest. A conviction on second-degree murder carries a possible prison sentence of 25 years to life. Doctors have been treating hundreds of people complaining of breathing problems after a blast at an oil refinery in San Francisco Bay. A local TV station reports about 600 people streamed into area hospitals following yesterday afternoon's explosion at the Chevron plant in Richmond, California. More on that as well. Potential jurors return to the courthouse in Laramie, Wyoming today, where a suspect is on trial in a crime that shocked the nation. Both sides are trying to pick a jury for the case of Russell Henderson. He's one of the two men accused of luring gay college student Matthew Shepard from a bar, then beating him and leaving him tied to a fence to die. 14 people in the jury pool were released yesterday, including two death penalty opponents. Opening statements are scheduled to begin in 2 weeks. European Union foreign ministers yesterday approved the text of declaration that would signal the EU's strongest support to date for the Palestinians' right to declare their own state. The text says the Palestinians have an unqualified right to self-determination, including the option of a state, and adds that the 15-nation union looks forward to the early fulfillment of that right. Some 15,000 Nicaraguans marched yesterday in a mass protest against government corruption in the face of persistent poverty and social problems in their country. The protesters chanted no to corruption in the largest street protest in recent memory, aiming their anger at President Arnaldo Alemán, whom they claimed has lined his pockets in office. A group of black workers is suing Mitsubishi and the United Auto Workers Union, claiming they've been harassed and denied promotions. 21 workers say they had to endure racist graffiti and jokes from co-workers at a Mitsubishi plant in Normal, Illinois. They also say they were put on heavy labor assignments despite having medical conditions. In their court complaint, they accuse both the car maker and the union of ignoring what allegedly went on. They claim the problems have existed since the plant opened a dozen years ago. Also from Illinois, a Methodist minister who presided at the wedding of two gay men went on trial yesterday before a jury of 13 pastors in the first test of a church law banning same-sex ceremonies. The Reverend Gregory Dell of Chicago, a pastor for 30 years, could be defrocked if found guilty. A verdict is expected tomorrow. Facing abuse of power charges, the Paraguayan president, Raul Cubas, went on trial in Paraguay's Senate today, proceedings hastened by the assassination of the vice president. Cubas is accused of abusing his powers by freeing former army chief Lino Oviedo, his ally and mentor. Oviedo was released from jail in August, just months after he was sentenced to 10 years for attempting to oust then-president Juan Guasmosi in 1996. San Jose, California police will soon be noting the race, age, and sex of every motorist they stop, along with the reason the driver was pulled over. The survey is to see whether motorists are being stopped for what civil rights activists call driving while black. Police Chief Bill Lansdowne says there is a perception that officers make car stops based on race, gender, and dress. Lansdowne says if the information reveals improper patterns in a city, changes will be made. San Diego announced a similar program last month. And finally, there were two executions last night. 44-year-old man executed by injection in Texas. In Virginia, a 57-year-old man executed by injection for a murder for hire. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And clearly, as these demonstrations in New York have been mounting, the announcement last night of the indictment or the pending unsealing of an indictment of four police officers in the horrific shooting of Amadou Diallo 7 weeks ago.
That's right. This is major news. Of course, it's always hard to confirm this kind of thing because the indictments have yet to be unsealed. But four white police officers who shot and killed Amadou Diallo, the unarmed Guinean immigrant, have been charged, according to reports, with second-degree murder in the case that has led to days of protests and hundreds of arrests. The charges in the sealed grand jury indictment were confirmed by a source close to the case who spoke on condition of anonymity to the Associated Press. The charges will not be formally announced until, at least at this point, Monday morning. Diallo was the 22-year-old street vendor who was killed February 4th outside his Bronx home, struck by 19 of the 41 bullets fired at him. Police said officers Sean Carroll, Kenneth Boss, Edward McMillan, and Richard Murphy were searching for a rape suspect. Some officers also face lesser charges, according to reports. They were assigned paid desk duty during the investigation and have not commented publicly. Lawyers said they declined to testify before the grand jury. The shooting has strained relations between the African-American and Latino communities and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, and that tension has increased to communities beyond those of color. Juan?
Well, of course, Amy, there's been a lot of speculation in the local, the New York press in the last few days as to whether the four police officers would go before the grand jury. I never expected them to go before the grand jury because clearly any defense lawyer would tell you if that you suspect an indictment is going to occur, why have your client testify in a grand jury where then that testimony could be used to raise contradictions in if the officers wanted to go actually on the stand during their trial. So they were never going to go before that grand jury. And all of this speculation about the possibility was just that, a media hype. And in reality, of course, this is the second-degree murder charge, which basically alleges that the officers acted with depraved indifference to human life or acted with reckless disregard for human life, would necessarily follow since the grand jury got no other testimony other than those people who may have heard parts of the incident at the scene. And of course, these officers are expected to ask for a non-jury trial because any jury trial in the Bronx or I guess any place in New York City at this point where you have 12 members of the community would be hard-pressed not to find the conviction, so that they're going to go before a single judge of the Supreme Court of the Bronx. And now the big question is going to be, who is the judge that is selected to handle this explosive case? And then what witnesses will actually be brought forth? But the trial, of course, will be months into the future. And before that happens, in another couple of weeks, we start the trial for the cops accused in the Abner Louima attack a year and a half ago. So that's going to be the focus. And there's also a huge demonstration already being planned for April 15th in New York City by a coalition of labor leaders, politicians, Black and Latino community leaders, which promises probably to be the most massive demonstration against police abuse in this city's history.
And before that, April 3rd, there's a national demonstration planned for Washington, D.C., called by the Center for Constitutional Rights Against Police Brutality. But there have also been protests every single day for the last 2 weeks, and the numbers of people being arrested have increased. At this point, we're talking about more than 800 people in this past week. African Americans, Asians, Latinos, Jewish leaders, groups of seniors and youths, notables from the NAACP like Kwasi Mfume, Oscar-winning actress yesterday Susan Sarandon, arrested with 218 other people. In fact, Jeremy Scahill, the Pacifica reporter, was out at New York Police Plaza yesterday to cover those arrests. This is his report.
The city of New York continues to be engulfed with unprecedented daily protests against police brutality. Local civil rights leaders have declared a state of emergency in the city following the police killing of an unarmed West African immigrant in early February. Amadou Diallo was gunned down in a hail of 41 bullets by four white police officers, all members of an elite police squad known as the Street Crimes Unit. Yesterday, more than 200 people were arrested at police headquarters, and today that number was surpassed. Graham Witherspoon is a retired New York Police Department detective and is now head of a group called 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement.
Revolution is a change, and that's what this is. This is a change. There are various ways of carrying out a revolution, not just the way in which the so-called fathers of this country did, but there are many ways of carrying out a revolution, and this is a revolution. Yes, it is.
Mayor Giuliani called these protests silly. Your response to that?
The mayor is a fool. The mayor is the king dancing naked, presuming that he has clothing on. He is an out-and-out racist, he's a bigot, and he is a modern-day Bull Connor. That's the extent of his magnitude. He is Bull Connor in the flesh at the close of the 20th century, and he thinks it's 1953. It's not 1953 anymore.
Today at the Justice Department, Attorney General Janet Reno fended off questions about the Diallo killing and New York's record on police brutality.
What we need to do is to identify those that abuse the power that they have as police officers and take steps to see that they don't do it again.
Today was day 14 of the civil disobedience campaign at police headquarters, and the number of demonstrators has swelled each day as a Bronx grand jury deliberates what to do with the four officers who killed Amadou Diallo. People from all across the city have converged on one police plaza to protest what they see as an increasing police violence under New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani.
What does your sign say?
Says, it's from my son, Indicari. He's 8 months old. His name is Ian. And it says, when I grow up, I want to be big and strong, smart and free, in a world where I can be without police harassing me.
I figure if they arrest me, then, you know, it's for a cause. It's for a very good cause. It's been going on for many, many years, you know. And it's really been unchallenged until right about now, and I think this is a wake-up call. You know, it's a home calling.
But whether or not Mayor Giuliani is hearing that call is unclear. He has called the protests silly and said this week, "I know what unrest is, and there is no unrest in this city." The mayor has consistently dismissed the daily rallies as publicity stunts and has even said the police are now the victims of abuse.
I think this is getting to be a really abusive situation in the sense of trying to use the police in ways that are highly inappropriate. And I think that they're over the top now. This is like the piling on time where everybody is hoping, let me see if I can get a camera. And unfortunately, you keep obliging.
Arrest Giuliani! Arrest Giuliani!
About 30 members of the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association also turned out to protest against the protests.
What does your sign say, sir?
So stop the cop bashing.
Why did you come out here today?
Came out here to support the four officers that are involved because it's a tragedy what happened. And me as a police officer 18 years, feel that it was an accidental shooting or tragedy, and that's about it.
Arrest!
arrest Giuliani!
Among those arrested were actress Susan Sarandon and ex-Congressman Floyd Flake of New York, who was one of the few African-Americans in New York to support Mayor Giuliani. Protest organizer Al Sharpton spoke to reporters during the arrests.
Clearly, they have chosen not to give a reason as to why they shot an unarmed man 41 times, so there's no reason for them not to be prosecuted. And we're here. Today was a significant day for us. I had no idea when we started this 13 days ago that the mayor's staunchest black supporter would come, but he has, which is why I walked him all the way to the door, because to me this is the most significant arrest, because it buries the mayor's thing of saying this is partisan. When Floyd Flake and Al Sharpton are together, the mayor has to understand he has got to really deal with this issue.
When will you stop? When will you stop?
When they're arrested.
What do you expect from Mayor Giuliani?
He should have suspended the police. He should have said you have the right not to come forward. But if you do that, I will have to take your badge and gun, because I have no reason to trust you stay on the force if there's no explanation why you shot an unarmed man 41 times. That does not interfere with their due process. That protects the public.
The four officers have all declined to testify before the grand jury, and each of them has yet to be questioned by anyone, whether media or government officials. They remain on active duty with their guns. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, Juan, those protests are continuing because, while Al Sharpton said he would end the protests once the arrests happened of the four white police officers who killed Amadou Diallo, he is now saying that they're going to continue these protests until there are major reforms in policy around the police department. For example, that they will not have a 48-hour rule where they can simply be totally silent and not tell anyone what happens so they can consult with their lawyers, etc. It's not a right regular citizens have, as well as challenging the residency rule in New York City. Police officers do not have to live within the five boroughs.
But and also the a big issue is the question of whether there will be federal oversight or monitoring of the New York City Police Department. And that's been that's going to be a growing issue, a concern, as the protests move from the particulars of the Diallo situation to the general widespread problem that many people see of unchecked police abuse that's coming from the top of the police department.
That's right, Juan. And we heard the quote of Janet Reno, the attorney general, many have called on them to intervene in this case, to investigate. And we can see that these calls are coming from around the country to investigate state troopers, to investigate police. Just reading in those news headlines that in San Jose, the police will soon be noting the race, age, and sex of every motorist because of this issue. Civil rights activists have been talking about of drive while black, and we will continue to monitor the activities of the authorities as well as the police. In an interesting side light to what is going on in New York, there's been a big controversy over the police commissioner, Howard Safer, the fact that this past weekend he went to the Oscars, would not tell anyone where he was going, but what happened, in fact, was he went to the Oscars. I'm not quite sure what he was thinking. He was caught on television. Where are there more cameras per square inch than at the Oscars, caught in his tuxedo? There were questions about whether he would come back for police brutality hearings that were held by the New York City Council. He said he had some kind of scheduling conflict, but in the end, he took a red eye back instead of using the plane that the corporate sponsor that brought him to the Oscars and bought his $700 a night hotel room was giving. And that corporate sponsor was Revlon Incorporated. Now, at first, he said there was no conflict with the city of New York because they don't do business with the city. But it turns out that Revlon, the company that controls Revlon, actually hires off-duty New York City police officers in uniform to guard its offices at night under a city-sponsored arrangement that may complicate now the ethics inquiry into the police commissioner.
Yes, and supposedly Revlon, one of the security guards, was a police officer in uniform who guarded the block that not only has Revlon's offices but also has the home of Revlon's chief, Ron Perlman, New York's richest resident. So that you have the situation now of a corporate chief having private uniformed security of New York City police officers guarding his home.
And listeners around the country may have heard of Ron Perlman and his company Revlon and the company that owns it, because his name came up during the Senate impeachment trial of President Clinton. Vernon Jordan, when looking for a job for Monica Lewinsky, turned to Ron Perlman and his people. Well, we are going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll be looking at the issue of Kosovo. We will also be going to New Mexico to look at the deep desert grave that's awaiting its first load of nuclear waste. And we'll be going out to San Francisco Bay to the African-American community of Richmond, where a major Chevron explosion at an oil refinery took place yesterday. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we shift now to the issue of Kosovo and the continued NATO airstrikes against the former Yugoslavia. Roy Gutman has an interesting piece in Newsday. Roy Gutman is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on the former Yugoslavia. He says when the United States and its allies began dropping bombs and missiles in Yugoslavia to end the fighting in Kosovo, NATO, not the UN Security Council, gave the authorization. The UN Charter, the fundamental document regulating international peace and security, went unmentioned. Averting a humanitarian disaster was the ground most often cited, with Yugoslavia's failure to sign a peace agreement with Kosovar Albanians in second place. Top U.S. officials deny NATO's Kosovo intervention spells the eclipse of the Security Council, but it's clear that something has changed in the role that the United States and NATO ascribe to the United Nations. Now, interestingly enough, Juan, yesterday or the day before yesterday, when Kofi Annan, the U.N. Secretary General, spoke about the bombing, everyone quoted the first part of what he had to say, which was approving the bombing. But they didn't quote the second part of what he had to say, which clearly showed, once again, his frustration with the United Nations being bypassed. We'll give you the whole statement of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
I have appealed on many occasions to the Yugoslav authorities and to the Kosovar Albanians to seek peace over war, compromise over conflict. I deeply regret that in spite of all the efforts made by the international community, the Yugoslav authorities have persisted in their rejection of a political settlement which would have halted the bloodshed in Kosovo and secured an equitable peace for the population. It is indeed tragic that diplomacy has failed, but there are times when the use of force may be legitimate in the pursuit of peace. In helping maintain international peace and security, Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter assigns an important role to regional organizations. But as Secretary General, I have many times pointed out, not just in relation to Kosovo, that under the Charter The Security Council has primary responsibility for maintaining international peace and security. And this is explicitly acknowledged in the North Atlantic Treaty. Therefore, the Council should be involved in any decision to resort to force. Thank you very much.
That was UN Secretary General Kofi Annan speaking at a news conference. His full comment. And as he was speaking, the NATO airstrikes had begun. The NATO aircraft and missiles yesterday blasted targets in Yugoslavia for a second night, directing much of their fire on Kosovo, where fighting raged between Serbs and ethnic Albanians. Yugoslav forces yesterday continued their offensive on the ground in Kosovo against ethnic Albanians. President Slobodan Milosevic cut off diplomatic relations with the United States, France, Germany, Britain, while Serbian authorities ordered journalists from NATO nations out of the country. Today we're going to talk about two issues. Who benefits from the bombing, particularly the weapons manufacturers and what those bombs cost. And we're going to talk about the people who are commenting on TV about the NATO airstrikes. We're joined in our Washington studio by Chris Hellman, senior analyst of the Center for Defense Information, which is an independent nonprofit group that monitors military planning and policy. And in New York, we're joined by Jim Narikis, editor of Extra, the publication of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Chris Hellman, let's begin with you in Washington, D.C. What are the missiles being used? Who manufactures them? How much do they cost?
Well, predominantly, you're seeing the use of the Tomahawk cruise missile, which costs about $1 million per copy and is manufactured by Raytheon Corporation. The other most talked about weapon system is the stealth fighter, which was built in the early 80s by Lockheed Corporation, which is now part of Lockheed Martin Corporation, and they cost approximately $50 million apiece.
Now, Chris, in terms, ever since the collapse of the Soviet bloc, it seems to me we're seeing more and more regional conflicts in which the United States is getting involved and using its weaponry. What is, I mean, in terms of the corporations who manufacture these weapons, what's their direct interest in all this?
Well, it's hard to attribute a direct interest to weapons manufacturers. I mean, clearly any time their weapons are used, it increases the demand. And certainly in our direction of some foreign policy, they've played a central role, certainly with regard to NATO expansion. Defense contractors were on the ground very early in countries that were looking at possible inclusion in an expanded NATO, with the idea that as they began to rearm and to purchase weapons that would be interoperable with their NATO allies, they were going to be looking to buy American systems. And if corporations were already present there, they would have a step up in getting those contracts. So I think that in some cases that can be a real issue. Whether it's a factor in the increasing number of conflicts we've seen at the end of the Cold War, I think is debatable. I think you could probably say that and not be accused of being, a liar. But there are a lot of other factors that of course contribute to that.
You know, it's interesting, Chris Hellman, that when you've got Hungary and Czechoslovakia joining NATO and NATO increasingly becoming bigger, you do have that issue of the U.S. pressing very hard for everyone who joins NATO to buy U.S. weapons. At the same time, you have President Clinton proposing the biggest increase in the military budget since Ronald Reagan, in fact, even more than parts of Ronald Reagan's administration, and the whole Star Wars issue. Do you think that this attack is also being used as a way for President Clinton to justify his emphasis on the military now?
Well, I don't know necessarily if that's the administration's view on this. Certainly it is.
Well, obviously. They're not going to put that out.
Yes. Yeah, right. Right. Certainly it is the view, the candid view of a lot of supporters of increasing the defense budget, that it's these types of operations that require, in an uncertain world, that rather than to continue to reduce our military spending, we begin to ramp it back up again. And you probably shouldn't view military operations of this type in a vacuum, but I personally find it hard to attribute what's going on in Kosovo as being directly contributing factor to increasing defense spending. I think it does. I think it does provide rationale for that. But as a practical matter, I think that that's all that it is.
Jim Narikas is also with us, as we said, editor of Extra. Jim, these kind of issues are not raised very much in the media. I have to say, I saw a surprising BBC TV interview yesterday with Jamie Rubin, the State Department spokesperson, which for the first time, and this wasn't a U.S., obviously, media outlet, expressed some questions that perhaps all the NATO allies were not supporting what the U.S. was doing, that there was a fractured coalition. But I almost never see this in the United States. What I'm seeing in U.S. television are military analysts hired by the networks, former generals and military officers, talking about the NATO airstrikes. Can you tell us about who these people are and why they're being paid?
Yeah, there is a real tendency to go to the military for analysis in situations like this. Last night there was a segment on CBS News that said, Kosovo in crisis, assessment. And you think, oh, great, we're going to get the broad view. And assessment meant going to the Pentagon for their bomb damage assessment. And so assessment for CBS means here's what the Pentagon thinks that it's accomplished. And unsurprisingly, they felt they had accomplished a lot. And people go from being spokespeople for the Pentagon or officials at the Pentagon to being officials or spokespeople at the networks, where you have these people who spent their whole life in this institution coming out and really in many cases being still very strong advocates for the institution that they came out of.
Well, my concern is in terms of the coverage is that we seem now, and I repeat again this issue of these continuing regional conflicts, we are now technically, in reality, not technically because not declared, but we are now at war with two countries in two different parts of the world.
Right. One war of which has been almost completely forgotten by the press.
And it seems
there was not a single question about Iraq when Clinton gave us.
Exactly, and yet the aggression against Iraq continues, and it seems that somehow this issue of us being able to, in essence, wage war without losing very many soldiers because of the advances in technology has not really been addressed either in the media or, it seems to me, by a lot of the groups who are monitoring our government's military policy.
Bill Maher said last night on television, the comedian, with the airstrikes against Kosovo and Yugoslavia, President Clinton is cheating on Iraq.
One of the scary trends that you see in the media is the use of the word casualties to mean American casualties. Like John Hockenberry was saying on MSNBC, we have gotten used to wars where there's no casualties, which is, just such an Orwellian way of looking at that all the people who die on the other side are completely invisible.
Well, I think it was Colin Powell during the Persian Gulf attacks, what's called the Persian Gulf War, 1991, who said we don't care about how many Iraqis died. I was talking to one of the chief reporters at CNN asking this question about why their military analysts are paid. The Pentagon is more than happy to put out people to all the networks to express their point of view. Why are these people? I think Norman Schwarzkopf, after the Persian Gulf War, was given something like $2 million by CBS, and then they have to justify his contract by continuing to bring you special programs so that he can talk. But why are these guys on the payroll? And if they continue to be on the payroll, well, this CNN reporter said he agreed. He thought it actually was a serious compromise. But why don't they put peace activists on the payroll as well as analysts in these conflicts, Jim?
Well, there's a way in which the media want to wrap themselves in the mantle of the Pentagon. It's seen as sort of a danger to not be identified with the military in time of war. It's sort of the patriotism that tends to accompany wartime, which you, by the way, very much see in Yugoslavia right now, where the opposition is very much cowed because they're the country's under attack, and so they have to support the president for good or ill. And the media are often charged with being not loyal during wartime because they to the extent that they try to fulfill a journalistic role that is incompatible with the role of supporting your government as a propaganda apparatus. And so in a way, these military people are they're proof that, you know, we're on the side of the military and they're part of our organization. Though I have to say that the media in this conflict have had much more of an opening than we've seen in a lot of previous conflicts.
Although I think that where you have any discussion, for example, I see Patrick Buchanan on television raising questions
right.
about the attack on former Yugoslavia, it's the right wing. What you have is, people saying, but you don't have it expanded to progressives and peace activists, because the rationale for Pat Buchanan isn't
right.
about peace. It has to do with entering other countries, etc. And there's a certain xenophobia that is expressed. And although you have the two sides coming together, you just almost never see a peace activist speaking, and many press releases we've gotten from peace organizations talking about the issue and why
right.
they oppose it. In fact, right now on the line with us is Sarah Flounder. She's with the International Action Center in New York City, and they are coordinating protests all over the country for Saturday. Welcome to Democracy Now, Sarah.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what's happening?
Well, there's really opposition growing all across the U.S. and internationally. There'll be thousands in the street tomorrow in demonstrations. That's Saturday at 12 noon in New York, at Grand Central Station, in San Francisco, at Market and Powell, in Los Angeles at the Federal Building. There's actions in Detroit, Chicago, Ann Arbor, Madison. In Washington, D.C., it'll be on Sunday. If people want a full listing of demonstrations or actions, our website is a good place to go. That's www.iacenter.org. We're also gathering information on other demonstrations, so anyone who knows of actions, I would encourage them to just to contact us. We'll list it. There are international actions. There's things in London and Brussels. The opposition is growing. Of course, there were demonstrations on Thursday and some other actions Friday. Literally, as the bombs began falling, there has been opposition. The Saturday 12 noon demonstrations are an opportunity for many people to just begin coming out. So I would urge people to really, I think the idea of attacking a country that doesn't even have 3% of the population of the United States and whose military isn't even 1% the size of the Pentagon forces is what pushes people into the streets.
Well, Sarah Flounders, I want to thank you for joining us from the International Action Center, and the website there, www.iac.org. Also want to thank Jim Narikas of Extra, the publication of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as well as Chris Hellman, senior analyst with the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Well, Juan, we're going to go from explosions abroad to explosions at home. Doctors have been treating hundreds of people complaining of breathing problems after a blast at an oil refinery on San Francisco Bay. A local TV station, KTVU, reports 600 people streamed into area hospitals following yesterday afternoon's explosion at the Chevron plant in Richmond, California. Thick smoke could be seen for miles. Warning sirens were sounded to alert residents to stay indoors, but some complain they never heard them. It took firefighters more than 5 hours to contain the blaze, injuring three of them in the process. Chevron says all the refinery workers have been accounted for. The cause of the blast isn't known. An analyst is already suggesting Californians can expect gas prices to go up a lot. We're joined right now by Henry Clark, who's executive director of the West County Toxics Coalition, speaking from Richmond, where the explosion took place. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Henry Clark.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can you tell us what has happened, what you know at this point?
Well, what I know at this point is that by the 600 people have reported to our local hospitals complaining about a wide variety of health problems, breathing problems, and other complications. The actual cause of the explosion is still being investigated. That's about a summary of what had happened in terms of what the West County Toxics Coalition is doing. We have contacted leadership in the North Richmond area, the area there adjacent to the refinery that's on the front line of the chemical assault, as we said, the community that's hit the hardest every time there's a chemical disaster there. which has the North Richmond Municipal Advisory Council that actually governs that area, and I'm fortunate enough to be a member of that council also. We are going to be having a special meeting on Tuesday to have Chevron as well as other officials from the city of Richmond and inviting Congressman George Miller from our area to this meeting to give some explanations to our community as to why we continue to face these type of chemical disasters and hold these companies accountable to preventing these type of disasters in the future. So that's in the making now.
Henry Clark, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll be back with you of the West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond and Skylar Fishman of Communities for a Better Environment. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue on the issue of the oil refinery of Chevron that had a major explosion yesterday. We're used to reporting on Chevron in Nigeria, one of the poorest areas of Nigeria, the Niger Delta, and their involvement with the killing of activists there, not to mention their environmental practices. Richmond, in some sense, as we talked to one Nigerian activist who went out to protest at Chevron headquarters in California, is, as he put it, the Niger Delta of the United States. Henry Clark of the West County Toxics Coalition, could you describe your community?
Well, the North Richmond area is a primarily low-income Afro-American, Latino, and Asian community, a population of about 2,400 people. They're adjacent to the Chevron refinery. So whenever there's a chemical disaster, a chemical release, that community is hit first and foremost. That's why we say that that community is on the front line of the toxic assault. Now, in terms of comparing it to Nigeria, I have been working with the Nigerian people in the area. I've also met with several groups working in Nigeria, and we just recently met with some Chevron officials at their corporate headquarters on the situation in Nigeria.
And Henry Clark, I'd like to ask you, when you say these are continuing disasters, how frequent have these been, and how many chemical and companies and petroleum refineries are there in your area?
Some noise in the background. In terms of the frequency of it, they're spread around the county. There's refineries throughout the County in Richmond, you have a Chevron.
We're going to try to fix that sound. I think it's the cellular phone of our previous guest. We're just fixing it right now. We are talking to Henry Clark, Executive Director of the West County Toxics Coalition. Go ahead, Henry.
Yes. Yes, there's refineries throughout Contra Costa County that have the switch from different times to which refinery is having the problem. Where it may be Chevron today, Shell in Martinez tomorrow, or Tosco refinery in Martinez the next day. But the accidents continue to happen at these refineries. And we have to look at what is really the cause of these refineries have been in existence over the hundreds of years. Chevron was started out in the early 1900s there in Richmond. These corporate executives pushed these companies to the limit to try to make profits at the expense of the worker safety and the community, and they don't really invest in the modernizing of these facilities like they should. And these refineries are just breaking down due to wear and tear, and that puts the workers as well as the community at risk, as you've seen with the Chevron explosion yesterday, as well as the fire at the Tosco refinery in Martinez that killed four workers in February.
And that was just on February 23rd, right?
That's correct.
Henry Clark, we're also joined by Skylar Fishman. She's the noise in the background because she's speaking to us from a cellular phone on the highway. Welcome to Democracy Now, Skylar.
Good morning.
Skylar is with Communities for a Better Environment. What are you doing about the Chevron explosion yesterday?
Well, we work with community groups in Richmond and also our own members in Richmond on something called the Bucket Brigade Project, which is a community right-to-know project. Basically, there's about an accident every 5 weeks in Contra Costa County. Chevron's had a major incident once a year for the last 10 years. And every time that happens, the officials say there's nothing toxic in the smoke, or you know, there's going to be no impacts on the community from the smoke. But people in the community are breathing it and they're feeling it. And I was out there yesterday. I was breathing it. I was feeling it. So they decided they wanted to take their own air samples, and that's what we did. We started a project so that people could take their own low-tech air samples. Community members in Richmond last night took 8 samples. And we were sitting around getting them ready, filling out all the chain of custody reports to send them to the lab so we could find out what was really in that air.
And Skylar Fishman, has there been any epidemiological studies done of cancer rates and other illnesses in the area? Because I remember many years ago when I was a reporter in Philadelphia, we did a study of South Philadelphia where there was a concentration of oil refineries. Similarly, had many accidents, and we found an incredibly high level of cancer deaths and cancer incidents in the neighborhoods around those refineries. Have any studies been done there in your area?
No specific studies have been done. It's really, really needed because, as most people know, Contra Costa County is called the Cancer Crescent. It's a common health worker knowledge that the cancer rate is very high. Another problem, especially in Richmond, is asthma, especially among the children, is very high. I think it's doubled over the last 10 years. And, you know, certainly there are environmental health problems out here, but they have not been adequately studied. Mm.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and we hope to get a report on the meeting that you have, Henry Clark, the West County Toxics Coalition, next week on what you plan to do about this explosion and the continued problems that you have with oil refineries in your area. This latest explosion of the Chevron plant, that's the largest corporation headquartered in California. In fact, the Richmond refinery of Chevron is its first refinery, the second being the El Segundo refinery in Los Angeles, which also has had a number of major problems and issues of pollution in Los Angeles. Thank you very much to Henry Clark and to Skylar Fishman of Communities for a Better Environment. As we continue with our environmental stories today, New York Times has a front page story out of Los Alamos saying putting a coda on the Cold War, a flatbed truck rumbled out last night from this atomic city, the birthplace of nuclear weapons, Los Alamos, carrying an inaugural shipment for the world's first deep underground nuclear waste depository. After $2 billion, 25 years of environmental studies, political protests and legal challenges, the depository outside Carlsbad, 256 miles southeast of Los Alamos, is to receive its first waste shipment this morning. On Monday, a federal judge in Washington allowed the plant to receive the first shipment of nuclear waste, although a state permit is still pending for later shipments of waste mixed with hazardous chemicals. At the same time, this week, the Department of Energy selected 6 commercial nuclear power plants in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia to burn plutonium from nuclear weapons stockpiles. The department will also pay $130 million to a consortium of power companies to design the plant to make the fuel. Well, right now, we are joined by 2 people to talk about the issue of nuclear waste. Myla Resson is with us, a member of the Citizens for Alternatives to Radioactive Dumping, which is based in Albuquerque. And this group has led efforts against the storage of radioactive waste in New Mexico. And Arjun Makajani joins us, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, to talk about plutonium. Myla Resson, let's begin with you. Tell us about this Carlsbad deep desert grave awaiting its first load of nuclear waste, and what kind of protests have taken place?
Sure, it's Myla Reason, and we were protesting last night on the highway, but I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the site and the waste. The waste is contaminated with plutonium, which is both in soluble and aspirable form, and it's going to be traveling through 22 states, through the territory of 14 Indian tribes. Over the next 35 years, approximately 33,000 shipments will be going to WIP, and the facility has not been accurately characterized. There's highly pressurized brine below it and an aquifer above it, which flows into the Pecos River, the Rio Grande, and into the Gulf of Mexico. We believe that this will have catastrophic consequences on both sides of the border.
WIP being the waste isolation pilot plant. WIP being the waste isolation pilot plant.
That's right.
And now that a federal judge has given the go-ahead, what are the remedies that are left to you?
Well, you know, we really haven't received due process because we're appealing the Environmental Protection Agency certification of the site, and our appeal is scheduled for oral argument in May. So not only is the RCRA permit pending, but our appeal is pending as well.
Arjun Makajani, can you relate what's going on in Carlsbad, New Mexico today to this other issue of the Department of Energy selecting six commercial nuclear power plants to burn plutonium from nuclear weapons?
Yeah, the Cold War has left us with a lot of different kinds of plutonium problems, and these are two expressions of the legacy of the Cold War. The first, which is plutonium-contaminated wastes, from most of which are from weapons production. But those shipments that are actually taking place from Los Alamos won't do anything to get rid of the legacy of the Cold War because they're not part of the plutonium wastes that were made during the Cold War. These are actually plutonium-contaminated wastes that were created by these power modules that NASA uses in its space and satellites and so on. So the first wastes actually have nothing to do with the Cold War, and it's very misleading what has been written in the New York Times and what the Department of Energy has said. There is a real problem with plutonium-contaminated waste in the weapons complex. Much of this waste, the largest volume, is actually not contained in these drums that are going to be shipped. These drums are relatively safely stored today where they are. The most dangerous plutonium waste was actually dumped in the ground before 1970. It is leaking into the soil and threatening the most precious water resources in the West, like the Columbia River and the Snake River Plain Aquifer. And the Department of Energy is doing little or nothing to address these threats. And in the future, these dumps, which are shallow dumps, could become plutonium mines for potential terrorists. They could go and mine this plutonium after people forget that plutonium was dumped there, and if site control is lost, it could be very dangerous. So the department is playing a shell game with waste, moving them from one place to another while ignoring the most important problem. The same kind of thing is happening, but in a different way. The bottom line in the WIP program has not to do with waste disposal or management. The bottom line in the WIP program, it seems to me, is to create room in the storage sites at Los Alamos and other places so they can go on making more nuclear weapons. So it's really a production program. And you have the same kind of disease on the reactor side. We've got a lot of surplus plutonium from the weapons program. There are a lot of weapons being dismantled. No one knows. There's no good answer to the management of this plutonium. But it can be managed if we recognize that it really is a waste product of the Cold War.
Arjun Makajani, I'd like to ask you, what is the scope of the problem? What are we talking about here in terms of volume of plutonium from all sources of nuclear waste that's out there?
Well, the plutonium-contaminated waste, actually the buried waste, the Department of Energy does not itself have an idea of what is the volume and radioactivity content. It has inventoried this radioactivity content and volume at only one out of six sites or five sites, which is at Idaho, and it found it had almost 10 times as much radioactivity in this waste that they initially thought. Their waste numbers keep jumping around from year to year. We've told the department that they should at least inventory their buried waste, but they have not done a good job of it. But at least we know that there are hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of this buried waste at Los Alamos in Idaho, in Washington State, and Savannah Riverside.
Can I just say that, you know, Arjun made a really good point. WIP is for future waste from future nuclear weapons production. This is a Westinghouse project. They've made $2 billion on it already. It may be a $35 billion project or a $45 billion project before it's finished. I went to Mexico last week, and I met with legislators in Mexico City. And when I told them that the facility was for future waste, they asked if we were still making nuclear weapons in the United States. And when I told them, yes, we were, and that our budget for nuclear weapons production and development is greater than it's ever been in history, every jaw in the room dropped. This is one of the best-kept secrets in the world, that we're still making nuclear waste, I mean nuclear bombs, and we're dedicating more money than ever to that pursuit.
Hmm. And on the reactor side, what is happening is people long ago during the Cold War had this dream that we're going to use plutonium as a power source in nuclear reactors. They thought it would be cheap. They said nuclear power would be too cheap to meter. That was all really Cold War propaganda, but now thousands of jobs were locked up. Many careers were locked up in that kind of idea. That kind of idea went out the door in the 70s and 80s because of proliferation threats from plutonium. But now it's coming back through the back door, what to do with surplus plutonium. And instead of storing it safely and putting it in a non-weapons usable form, the nuclear industry and many others think that it would be a good idea to put it in reactors and use it as a fuel. This will make reactors more risky. All but three U.S. reactors were not designed to use plutonium fuel. They're designed to use uranium fuel. Weapons plutonium has never been used as a fuel in commercial reactors. So, and this $130 million contract, by the way, is a cost-plus contract. This is a return to the bad old days of atomic energy contracting, when people could have cost overruns and they'd simply be compensated by the government. It's a blank check to these contractors.
We only have a minute to go, and I wanted to go back to Myla Reeson. Could you tell us now what your plans are, as today is the day that the nation's that the radioactive waste made this historic journey to the nation's first nuclear waste dump?
Right. Well, about 100 demonstrators in Santa Fe stood by the roadside and watched the trucks roll by on their way to Carlsbad. And I realized yesterday, I've been fighting this for 11 years, and I realized yesterday that I've been fighting this because this is part of nuclear weapons production and development, and that's what I'm really opposed to. So, you know, I just have to redirect my energy to make sure that we stop making nuclear bombs.
The number of your organization, Citizens for Alternatives to Radioactive Dumping in Albuquerque?
505-266-2663.
One more time?
505-266-2663.
And Arjun Makajani, your organization, the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, that conducts technical studies on environmental issues, specifically looks at nuclear weapons?
Right. You can find a lot of information on our website, www.ieer.org. You can write us through our website also. If you want to call us, you can call us at 301-270-5500.
Thank you both very much for being with us, and that website, www.ieer.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Thanks to Joe Gill and Dan Coughlin in Washington, D.C. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On Monday, we'll be speaking with Gloria Steinem and Marcia Gillespie.